Yeah, Frank here has got his own billiard room.
Yes, it's what do you call it, Kramer?
Billiard room.
No, not billiard. Not the billiards. It was...
Billiards room.
Come on already. Come on. We call it the...
The place to be.
The place to be. Yes, the place to be.
Then I shall be there.
Now, it's time. Live and in living color.
The Grandy Man can.
Time to play the game!
Well, you always left me satisfied and smiling, so...
That's what she said.
Why do I want this? I want to make bank, bro. I want to get ass. I want to drive a Range Rover.
Place to be nations. Scott Criscola and Justin Rosero. This is the Place to Be podcast.
Very nice, Mr. Criscola.
Oh, I'm sorry, Dennis.
And then they trash him and say he's a fucking pill-popping, you know, piehead or whatever when he left.
Fuck you, Daddy.
I don't know what the fuck the Department of Health is.
To do worse than Josh Richard.
Place to Be Nation, welcome back to another great episode of the one and only Place to Be podcast. I am your co-host, Justin Rosero, and joining me, as always, for this very special occasion is my PIC, Scott Criscola. Scott, how you doing?
JR, it is always a pleasure to talk to you. Happy Thursday night, and welcome everyone to episode 150... Make sure I get the number correct.
154.
154. I almost went one over, but I'm just so excited because this is an extremely special episode of the Place to Be podcast. We have one of our exemplary guest interviews. We have an extensive catalog for those that have obviously already listened, but tonight is going to be a very special one. It's a guy you and I have always been a fan of, and throughout his travails in professional wrestling has hooked up with some of the greatest of all time and some of the most interesting characters of all time.
Yes.
We're going to talk about that and a lot more tonight. JR, why don't you bring our guest in?
Of course, our guest was once known as Harvey Whippleman in the WWF in the mid-90s, and that is the great Downtown Bruno Lauer. Bruno, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Well, thank you for having me. It's an honor, and I have to give a special shout-out to my good friend from Salt Lake City, Utah, Mr. John Sturm, who had hooked us up together, which I'm grateful for, and... I hope he's listening. I want to say a special hello and a thank you to him, and I'm proud to be here.
Awesome, and yes, thank you to John as well, because he did hit me up with the email and said you were interested and got this whole ball rolling. So,
where are y'all located? Are y'all in Salt Lake City as well?
No, I'm actually in Rhode Island, and Scott's in Connecticut.
Oh, okay, so y'all are up in the New England area.
Yes, we are.
Yeah. I actually drive by the WWE Towers. I drive by Titan Towers every single day on the way to work. So,
oh, you must drive down to the city, huh?
Yeah, well, no, I actually work in Stamford. I work in Stamford. Yeah, I work near the water, so I get off exit 8, and your esteemed building is off exit 9. So
that's right, exit 9, Glenbrook.
Glenbrook, yeah, we actually have a facility like a minute and a half, like 2 minutes away from the Titan Towers facility. Incidentally, Bruno, I actually have a resume sitting in some file cabinet, probably from 1997. It was probably used for Steve Austin's beer budget 12 years ago. But it was sitting in there for a while anyway. But anyway,
well, I'm not in the corporate end, so I wouldn't be able to tell you much about that.
You actually had the more fun side of the business, that's for sure. All right, we're going to go through everything tonight. You have managed and worked with, as yourself, you were one of our favorites, but you've also managed and worked with some of the greatest and some of the more unique and interesting characters in the history of the business, and we're definitely going to dive into it. Why don't we start in the beginning? Where are you from? What part of the country are you from? Did you get into wrestling as a kid? Were you a fan as a kid? Tell us about your upbringing.
Well, I'm from Wiles, Mississippi, DeSoto County, Mississippi, which is basically a suburb or a part of the Memphis, Tennessee metropolitan area. I'm literally in a car. I could be in Memphis, Tennessee, just across the state line in less than 2 minutes, and I could be in downtown Memphis in less than probably 15 minutes, depending on traffic. So that'll give you an idea of the, vicinity where I'm at. My family's basically from this area. I was actually, believe it or not, I was born in just outside of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, on the West Virginia line. But, I mean, I've lived my whole life here. This is home. That was never home. It just happened to be where I made my debut, where I came through the curtain, so to speak. But this was always my home. And I broke into business at the age of 13, which was actually 13 and a half, almost 14. 1979, I was born in 65, so basically 14, depending on, you know, how you look at it. But I didn't have time to be a fan. I was too busy trying to figure out a way to survive and make a living. Even at that age, you know, things was rough. And then I thought I hit the jackpot when I got my first opportunity in the business. I never looked back, so here I am.
How did you first get involved in the business? I know there was a gentleman by the name of Jonathan Boyd of the Royal Kangaroos. How did that get started, and how did you hook up with him, and when did it all begin?
Well, he was part of the crew on one of the towns I was working on, putting up the ring. And, you know, I told him I wanted to be a manager, and I was working on being a manager and so forth. And he helped me get that going. And, you know, at one time he was a pretty good friend to me. He kind of got a little bit, I don't know if it was senile or addled or what. I don't want to cast aspersions, but I'm not sure. But he kind of became very different and abusive after a while. And but he did help open some doors for me when I first started out in the business. But basically, I got my break in 84 from the King, probably my dearest friend, Jerry the King Lawler, gave me my biggest break when he let me start managing on TV in Memphis. And I, you know, not to pat myself on the back, but I had a lot of good teachers, and I got over and I drew money, and I knew how to draw money. Like I said, I had some good teachers that taught me how to draw money. A lot of it came natural, you know, and I'm not bragging, it just did. It's not something somebody taught me how to go to the ring and manage. I mean, yeah, they taught me how to do certain aspects of the business, the technical aspects, but as far as getting out there and getting over, I guess I was lucky enough that it just came natural to me.
Now, Memphis, of course, is a beloved promotion by many. Tell us, just really being there at that time, and probably during its peak in the early 80s, just what was it like? What were those fans like? What was the atmosphere like? Jerry Lawler was, you know, so, so big there at the time. Any good stories or anecdotes from that early years of Memphis for you?
Oh, my God. I could keep you on the phone from now to this time tomorrow.
Oh, let's do it then. Let's do it, Bruno.
I'm telling you, brother, that was, honest to God, without a doubt, that right there, it was like I can literally, honest to God, see what Brad Pitt and Tom Cruise and, the George Clooney and those people go through whenever they go anywhere, you know, in Hollywood or New York, wherever they go, and the paparazzi, everybody knows them, and people are just following them. You can't get any privacy, and you can't get, you know, even going to a restaurant or a store or a place of business, a beer joint, whatever. I mean, honestly, God, people are going to think I'm lying, I'm bragging. I am not. Anybody that's ever been in the territory back in the days when the territories were the only thing, the only wrestling you could see in any particular, you know, part of the country, that will verify that I am not lying. We were the movie stars. We were the rock stars. We were it. We were the superstars of our part of the country. And I tell you, of every territory I've ever worked, and I've worked a lot of them before I went to work for WWE, Memphis was without a doubt the strongest, the most exposure, where the people were the most passionate. I mean, in Memphis, Tennessee, I mean, I'm serious. I am not joking. I could not go anywhere. It would be impossible for me to go eat anywhere. I would be surrounded. And don't forget, too, back in those days, not only was I well known, but I was hated, which was my goal. That was my job, to be hated. So I had people wanting to whoop me everywhere I went, you know. And if I was by myself, it was all, I couldn't go to the supermarket. I couldn't, only beer joint I could go to is the beer joint right here in Walls, where I'm, you know, my home is, where everybody knew me. Because you go up Memphis in a beer joint, I mean, eight times out of ten, somebody wants to fight you. And it's happened many times, you know, because it was just, I mean, I'm telling you, I'll never be able to relive it. It'll never be back again. But when I tell people this, some people don't realize, just, I mean, honest to God, that in the 80s, in the Memphis territory, I mean, I was like Brad Pitt, Tom Cruise, and I was just little bitty downtown Brewer, the heel manager. Jerry the King Lawler, Jeff Jarrett, Superstar Bill Dundee, Dirty Dutch Mantel, Jackie Fargo, Steve Kern, Stan Lane, Billy Travis. These guys that were beloved. I mean, it was like everywhere they went, it was Christmas every day. It was Santa Claus coming because here comes the King. Here comes the Superstar. Here comes the Fabulous Ones. Here comes the Golden Boy. Here comes Jackie Fargo. We were the true legends and the true superstars of our era in our area. I mean, that's the thing, though, that differentiates us from, like, Clooney and Cruz and those guys I keep throwing up, because they could go anywhere in the country, anywhere in the world, be treated that way. But I could go as far as Marianna, Arkansas, and they wouldn't know who the hell I was. You know, I'd go into a brand-new territory. This is the days before cable TV.
Right.
I mean, when I first left Memphis and went to work for NWA in Kansas City, it was like starting all over again. And the TV up there wasn't strong like it was in Memphis, so it was an uphill battle. No matter how good I was or thought I was or whatever, that TV, that one-eyed monster, is what makes you or breaks you. And that TV wasn't strong up there, and it was hard. I had to try to get over every night with every audience in every town we went to. It wasn't like Memphis, but no matter where I went in the territory, oh, hell, my reputation preceded me. They knew who I was, and they wanted to see me. Whether they loved me, they hated me, they loved to love me, they hated to hate me, they loved to hate me, they hated to love me. They didn't know what the hell to do with me, but they paid to see me.
Stopping in Memphis again for a moment, what was it like on the booking schedule? Because I know at the time they did the thing where half a year Jerry Lawler would book and then Jerry Jarrett would take over. Did you like that method? Did you think it worked? Did it make sense? Did it add, you know, some freshness to the territory to have that different voice come in on a rotating schedule like that?
Well, you know what it was? It was hard for a lot of the guys because, you know, Lawler would bring in his crew and use them or whatever. When Little Man, Jerry Jarrett, took over, that was his nickname, Little Man, but when he would take over, then he would bring his own crew in, and a lot of guys would get the notice and have to find a place to go, which back then, you know, there was a lot of places to go, a lot of territories. But still, nobody wanted to have to pack up and move on. Now, I was one of the lucky ones. I was one of the, you know, inner circle. I didn't have to go nowhere. Like me, Dundee, obviously Lawler, you know, Buddy Wayne, Eddie Marlin. You know, we were Mr. Guy Coffey, late, great Guy Coffey. You know, the Dave Brown, Lance Russell, you know, I could think of a few more if I had enough time to just stop and think, but I don't want to leave dead air. But there was a certain group of us that were, you know, I was going to be here. So it didn't affect me that much. It might have affected my position on the card. I mean, even when they brought in a new booker like that piece of, can you cuss on this or do you have to keep it PG?
Oh, no, go ahead.
You let, it, let okay. it fly.
All right, when they brought in that piece of shit, Eric Embry.
There you go.
Then all of a sudden, he wasn't using me no more. He wasn't going to use me. He's the booker, but he wasn't going to use me. Well, damn it, I'm part of the family, so he might not going to use me, but by God, I'm going to have a job, and I'm going to work, and if he don't want to use me, he ain't my boss. I worked for Eddie Marlin. I was in charge of the ring crew, so he couldn't tell me shit. And then he had me go over to, honest to God, if I wasn't a Christian man at that time, which I'm a Christian man my whole life, so I would never do this, but if I wasn't a Christian man, I would have killed Eric Embry. That's how bad I hated him, the way he tried to treat me when he came to Memphis.
I've heard a lot of things about Eric Embry, too, that aren't too pleasurable, even when he was in World Class with the Von Erichs, and I've read a lot of things that aren't too pleasurable about him, so hearing you say that doesn't totally surprise me. But
Well, he came in as the booker, and he had me go out there and let Miss Texas, Jacqueline Moore, whoop me from one end of the ring to the other at the Pipkin building over at the Mid-South Fairgrounds. I mean, over the top rope, on the floor, bang, busted me wide open, blood everywhere, just beat me like I was a guy that was, you know, paraplegic, just broken a business that day. And the next week at the same arena, he had the dirty white girl, who was Tony Anthony's valet, girlfriend at the time, wife later, whooping Miss Texas all over the ring. Now, wait a minute. A little bitty, dried-up girl can whoop Miss Texas, but Miss Texas can whoop me. What does it make me look like? A piece of shit. I never forgave him for it. I never forgave him for it. He was doing things like having Doug Gilbert, Eddie Gilbert, get squashed by the guys he brought in, Gypsy Joe, who was 70 years old or something at the time, and or what, 65 or whatever, and Texas Hangman, nice guys, but just, you know, they weren't that caliber. He was trying to hurt all the homesteaders. And it didn't work. He sent me out there in the battle royal one day when I was supposedly still a heel manager, but he didn't have me managing anybody. So I was just in the ring late. I was just in the territory doing nothing. But before, you know, he decided to call himself not using me. So I attacked Jamie Dundee. Yeah, I mean, working-wise, of course, but I mean, I attacked him in the battle royal and just started whooping him. And the people went crazy. I turned myself babyface. He still wasn't going to use me. And Lawler and him said, are you nuts? Did you hear that? He got the biggest pop of the night. I started working a program with Jamie Dundee week after week after week, and the houses came up because of that. Because Lawler wasn't even working at the time. He was so pissed off about Eric Embry and the way he booked and how he looked and how he worked and everything else. He took some time off from the ring just to watch the territory fall flat, which if it hadn't been for me and that angle with Jamie Dundee, it would have. Because nobody would pay 15 cents of play money to watch Eric Embry and another guy that was a good friend of mine, and he still is, and I like him, Tom Pritchard, but out there doing his Roddy Piper impersonation. It was the most embarrassing thing I ever seen in my life. Cable TV had came out since then. People knew that was Piper. It wasn't Pritchard. Rowdy Pritchard.
Oh, jeez. That's funny.
That was the worst period in my career, watching that happen. Eric Embry destroying the territory that's my love, my passion, my soul, my heritage.
Ugh. Now, when I was a kid, and as I'm a fan now, and Justin and I always talk about this, I'm a big fan of old school arenas and like the landmark arenas of all the great promotions when I was a kid reading the magazines and stuff. And obviously, Memphis, it's obviously the Mid-South Coliseum. I've never been there. What, just a quick overview, what was the place like? You know, I've heard things of Sportatorium as a dump, but you know, and other places are nice. But what was it like inside the Mid-South Coliseum? Was it a lavish place? Was it older? What was it like, just the place in general and for wrestling?
Well, I wouldn't say it was lavish, but it was certainly not a dump. It was a functional, very good, very old school, I guess, at the time, arena, big, you know, dome type arena. Good sizable dressing rooms and little office type small rooms for the stars. Like Lawler had his own dressing room. Jeff Jarrett had his own dressing room. There was a room for the girls. Like if there was any girls on the card that night or whatever. It had big, huge rooms where the, you know, one side was all the, let's just say, good guys, and one side was all the bad guys dressed. And there was a big, huge common area in the back. In between those sectioned off rooms. So remember, that's where Memphis State used to play basketball.
Right.
So that was the one side was Memphis State's, you know, dressing area, and the other side was that other school that came in, whatever. So we used that. There was a little room up in the front on the bad guy side that me and Tojo used to share, and it was our tradition every week. I'd go to the concession stand before the people got in and get us a bunch of hot dogs, and we'd sit in there and eat hot dogs and get ready to go to the matches. And I'd smoke cigarettes, drink beer, and at that time they didn't know it, but I guess I'm not going to get in trouble about it now since it's been 25 or more years ago. Sit there and drink beer and eat hot dogs, smoke cigarettes, go out there and manage, and go home.
At the time, Bruno, did you run into and cross paths with Andy Kaufman in Memphis at all, or was that before you got there?
Yeah, it was like right before I got there. He was there, I think, 82, 83, whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I was for Bob Geigel, working on the ring at that time. So I was in 83, 82, I was out there. In fact, I think 82 I had my first run in Hawaii, if I'm not mistaken. I didn't get the cross paths with him.
Any residual effect in the years following, like a bump in the crowd or anything, lingering from Kaufman's run?
Well, yeah, it put Memphis on the national map.
Right.
For sure, it was a very positive thing, and it put Lawler on the national map. And there's nothing, absolutely nothing negative about Andy Kaufman being a part of the Memphis territory, Memphis organization.
Now, one of the guys, Bruno, early on in your career that obviously was a lasting impact for you over the next few years in your career, he's one of those superstars that only goes by one name, regardless of what his last name or first name or nicknames are in any other promotions. He's always known as just Sid.
Right.
And you hooked up with him fairly early on in your career, right?
You know what happened was when I was leaving Kansas City for the second time to go to work for Alabama, the Continental Championship Wrestling. Robert Fuller asked me if I knew a big guy that they could bring in that was, you know, muscled up and tall and everything. They could put the Lord Humongous deal on, the mask and the outfit that was on the Mad Max picture or whatever. And I thought about Sid, who I'd met when he was just starting out in Memphis. And I said, hell yeah, I know a guy. And I didn't even get hold of him. And we got along, but at that time we weren't good friends or nothing. I didn't know how to reach him. I started making calls, and finally a good friend of mine, very obscure name probably to y'all, but hardcore people would remember Boss Winters, longtime manager in Memphis, lived in West Memphis, same place Sid did. So we tracked him down and got a phone number where I could reach him. And Sid was doing construction at the time, just wrestling here and there part-time. And I wanted to know if he wanted to go to Alabama territory. And he said he jumped on it. We went there, and the rest was history for him. He went from there back to Memphis, back to Alabama, and then to Eddie Gilbert brought him to I don't know if it was NWA or WCW at the time, but I think it was NWA, and he went there, and he went from there to WWE, and the rest is history.
Did you feel like he had that it factor? He was one of those guys that maybe not ever, you know, one of the best in the ring or whatever, but he always had that connection with the fans, that it factor that just made him feel like a star. And I know Scott and I both feel that way, always been Sid fans. Did you pick up on that right off the bat when he started working that Lord Humongous gimmick and started to take off? Did you feel like this is a guy who could make it?
Oh, yeah, without a doubt. I knew without a doubt. As a matter of fact, I was very surprised that WWE didn't bring him in as Lord Humongous straight out of Alabama when we were there. Because at the time, they were really getting, you know, taking off with the gimmicks and the, you know, the toys and the different, you know, cartoon type things. I thought that would have been an ideal thing for WWE, the Lord Humongous. But I don't know if it was copyright issues with the, you know, the Mel Gibson movies or what. I don't know, but maybe they just didn't think he was ready yet at the time. But it's hard to say because, like, Ultimate Warrior was never ready. He's still not ready.
He's not ready for anything. Maybe in the long run that was better for Sid not to go at that point, because he might have just been fed to Hogan or Warrior and never given a chance to become the star he became at WCW and really build his credibility up.
Well, that's one way to look at it. That's true. But I tell you what, at that time, though, if Lord Humongous would have went around with Hogan,
right? Yep.
I think that would have been a huge deal. And truthfully, I was ready. At that time, I had been in the business for, what was that, 87? So I had been in the business. I mean, I'd been in the business 8 years, so I was ready. But it took me another 2 years before I went to New York. But believe me, Sid would have got ready right quick. Maybe it would have been too soon. I don't know. But hindsight is 2020.
I'm sure being a member of the Horsemen didn't hurt early on. We gave him some national cred. But we'll get into his arrival in the WWF in a sec, because obviously that's about the time you arrived as well. So what was it like as you're in the business now and you're seeing things close up now? What was the – I don't want to say that Memphis wasn't an indie promotion by no stretch. I mean, it was a major –
No, it was a territory. Any place that you make your living and you get a booking sheet and you work five, six, seven nights a week, and that's your way you make your living. That's your job. It's not an indie. I want to clarify that to anyone that's listening. Indie is like a guy that has a one-off deal, or once a month, or once a week, whatever, and you have to have another job, and you have a regular job or whatever. No, territories and indies are two separate entities without, you know, no ifs, ands, or buts. Your territory was your job. That was it. That was not an indie by any means.
Yeah, I'm glad you qualified that. That's good. I think some people sometimes get confused with that. Oh, Memphis was a big indie promotion. No, it was not indie. It was a big deal, just like Florida and some of those other spots. Do you think now, current day, that the territory could come back? Obviously we have Ring of Honor, and there's a couple. You know, there's maybe one or two. But do you think a consistent national territory system could return, or do you think maybe it's to the point of no return in that aspect?
I'm almost afraid to say it might be the point of no return. And, you know, and I've had this conversation with Vince, you know, and he readily agrees with me that WWE may just be a victim of its own success, because, you know, the goose that laid the golden egg was the territory. That's where everybody came from at the initial nationwide and worldwide expansion of WWE, was the territories. Well, now, instead of guys working 8-10 years before they, you know, finally get to go to WWE, now they work 8-10 months, sometimes not at all, you know, and it's a shame, and it's nobody's fault, it just happened. And you can't, and you know, a lot of people want to lay the blame on Vince, but that's not necessarily the case, because as you noticed, Memphis was the last Indian standing. It was the last territory to consistently continue to make a living. Why? Two reasons. One, it worked with WWE, not against it. And second, Memphis tried to be Memphis. Memphis didn't try to be WWE. Well, a lot of other places tried to compete. You can't compete. You know what I mean? It's just, it's a different, you know, ball game altogether. And Memphis understood that. We were a regional place that was very, very, not just popular, but almost a religion here in the Memphis area. I mean, the traffic went down on Saturday mornings out on the Union Avenue and out on the parkways in Memphis and on 240 because everybody was home watching Memphis wrestling. So we realized what we had. A lot of places didn't have that to start with. And when they try to compete with something they couldn't compete with, well, that's like my good friend Roddy Piper might say, it's like bringing a snowball to a firefight.
That's true. Now, JR and I are huge. Actually, I should say Justin, because JR, we don't want to confuse with good old JR, of course. But
right.
Justin and I are huge fans of heel stables. We're Horsemen, DX, Evolution. We eat all that stuff up. I've been like that since I was a kid. You had a great – you managed a great stable early on in your career, the Stud Stable. And
that's right, the Stud Stable.
As part of that crew was a very young guy by the name of Mick Foley. What was he like early on, like that green in his career? How was he to work with, kind of new to the business?
Oh, he was a hell of a guy. I mean, we always got along real good. At one point, we all shared an apartment together in Montgomery. We were working for Continental, me and him, and got him Terry Sims and Jerry Stubbs, and a guy named Wayne Tatum, who worked on the ring, a guy named Mike Peden that was a referee, and other guys used to come in and out of that apartment. It was one that was provided to us by David Woods, the owner of the company, and as only people in our business can do, we managed to screw up a free freaking apartment. All we had to do was pay the utilities and the phone bill, and somehow it didn't get done.
Oh, jeez.
Because guys would give all the money. I'm not going to name the guy because it's 20-something years ago, but we all gave the money to the one guy to pay it, and the guy took off, left the territory with the money.
Oh,
yep.
Ugh.
So they took the apartment away. I ended up staying with Lou Fabiano. He had an apartment. He had a wife at the time. So I ended up staying with him. Everybody else filtered off to wherever else. And not long after that, the territory went under. So I went to Louisiana for a while to work for Edward Falk and Jim Carpenter. Then I came back home to Memphis for a while. And then I went to New York. So, but yeah, Mick and me got along real good. He was a good guy. Still is.
Now, we shoot ahead to the summer of 1991 and the arrival of your good friend, Lord Humongous, but he arrived, of course, as Sid Justice. And then a few months later, you came on the scene in New York. I love that. I love when our guests and guys still call it New York. It's just got that old school feel. I love it.
Right.
What was the?
I was there for a while before I made my debut on TV. I was there behind the scenes every week for quite a while, actually. I just hadn't made my debut yet.
Oh, okay. What were the circumstances around you getting there and being hired by WWE?
Well, obviously at that time I'd already been in the business for 9 or 10 years or whatever. So everybody knew me pretty much, and I'd already, you know, had conversations in the past about them. The timing was never right. Well, about that time, they said they, you know, they weren't really crazy about one of the managers that was up there at the time. I'm not going to mention his name either. I'm not here to disparage anybody or anything.
Right.
I'm going to guess it was the coach, John Tolos.
Well, you know, honestly, I'd rather not say.
All right. I think I nailed it.
So they brought me up for a tryout, just a tryout.
Yeah.
Period. There was no guarantees of any kind. Sid had talked to him about me. They knew who I was. They flew me to Worcester, Mass., or flew me to Boston and drive over to Worcester, Mass. For a tryout. Vince told me, he was very gracious, very nice to me the first time I met him, told me to get out there and do an interview with Mean Gene and show him something that he's never seen before. He said he's seen plenty of heel managers go out there and argue and, you know, call the people names and whatever. He said, get out there and show me something I've never seen on my television show before. Of course, it was in the dark, but still we had to, you know, like it was on TV. So I was going back and forth with Mean Gene, and I'm saying to myself, well, so far we're just arguing back and forth, and there's nothing Vince ain't seen before. And Gene was putting me down, being from Mississippi, and, you know, this, that, and the other, and how dare do I look down on these wonderful New England people and so forth. And I leaned back, and I slapped the shit out of Mean Gene. And he looked at me, I looked at him, and I said, that's what you get for talking down to me, and let me tell you, and blah, blah, blah. So I said, well, this is it. I'm either heading back to Memphis, going back in charge of the ring crew, or I got myself in, one or the other. So I got in the back, and everybody looked at me, Geno Monsoon, J.J. Dillon, Pat, Chief, everybody. And Vince called me to the side. He says, I didn't like the slap. I thought, oh, boy, here we go. He said, I didn't like it. You didn't hit him hard enough. When Mean Gene comes to the back, I'm going to yell at you for slapping him and tell you never do that again. Now, tomorrow night, we're going to do the same deal in Portland, Maine. I want you to slap him and lay it in. Slap the shit out of him. So, long story short, the time I got back to Mississippi, I had a contract in my mailbox, and it's been over 20 years now, so he ain't called me into the room and said, oh, yeah, about that slap, you're fired, so I guess I'm all right.
Exactly. Now, you came in, and I remember, I know you did some spots. I think you managed the Warlord briefly, was one of your first guys, but one of your first charges, before we even get to Sid, one of your first charges is one of my PICs, my partner in crime's most beloved guys, and he's been waiting since we've been starting this show, Bruno. He's been waiting for the moment to talk to you about this guy. So, JR, the floor is yours. This is all you. Go ahead.
Bruno, tell me about Big Bully Busick. One of my favorites as a kid, and he was barely ever on TV. He used to kill me.
Well, let me tell you. I've said some things about him in my book in the past, and I've said some things about him on different interviews in the past, but then I've did a lot of thinking. He was a really nice guy. He's a super guy. I was actually on an autograph deal with him in New Jersey a couple of years ago. He wasn't ready for that schedule, that level in the business, okay? Basically. But he's not a bad guy. But it just, that wasn't his cup of tea. And he knew it, and he even said it later. But he was not a bad person by any means. I like him. To this day, I like him. He's got a good heart and, you know, looks like one of them old muscle men, you know, like you see on the, you know, the old posters, the old movies or whatever. But it just wasn't the life that suited him. Let's put it like that.
I mean, it's so bad because I thought the two of you together had a great look. And like you said, it had that old-timey kind of feeling to it where he really was just like a bully. And I remember vividly, there was a thing on Primetime Wrestling where he was bullying some fans, and I think it was Macho Man came out and got in his face, and I thought this was going to start this big feud at the time, and then he just kind of disappeared, and I remember being pretty upset as a kid. I started watching like in mid-1990, so he was one of the first guys I kind of got into for some reason. I don't know why. I don't know what it was, but...
Well, you got to remember why it didn't develop any further. Once they seen him have matches with guys that were good workers, like Coco Beware and Owen Hart and British Bulldog, and the matches all sucked. Well, they knew Coco didn't suck. They knew Davey didn't suck. They knew Owen didn't suck.
Yeah.
So, you know, simple mathematics came down to it. And again, I'm not saying he sucked, but he just, that wasn't his style, I guess, you know. And like I said, he's a really good guy, and I hope he's doing really well in life. I really do. Last I heard, he was head of security at a pretty good-sized casino up in West Virginia, I think it is. So I hope he's doing real well.
Oh, good for him. That's good. I'm glad he was able to get out one piece and you know, be successful. So I just one of my early kind of quirky favorites. I was always into.
Yeah, I hope he's doing. I'm glad he's doing well. I hope he still is because I don't know what I'd do without the business. I'd be out walking around picking up cans or something. That's all I know how to do.
Well, you can come be a co-host here. It doesn't pay, but you can come. You can hang out with us.
Maybe the bully will make you a pit boss. You know, you never know.
Right.
All right, JR, we have a field trip now. We got to go to West Virginia now.
That's right. Okay, we got to go find the bully.
We got to go find B-Cubed for you.
Now, Bruno, right. Did you feel when the bully made his exit, did you feel that you were maybe kind of going to be left in the wind, or was your next setup already in place by then?
That was already in place. Okay. The one thing, the WWE doesn't do business like that. If you're in partners with somebody, so to speak, business-wise, and that person screws up, they do not screw you.
Right.
Like Mr. Hughes, who's when you look up screw up in the dictionary, there's a picture of him.
We'll get to him later.
Yeah, but I'm going to tell you, boys, that cost me a fortune, a freaking fortune, because we're going to be the main event with Undertaker. So, but now, that's a long story.
Now, 1991 was a unique year for WWE. It started off, you know, Warrior was champion, and then, you know, Slaughter beat him at the Rumble. We had all the Iraq, you know, Desert Storm, and of course, you know, all the patriotism, and then Hogan beats him at WrestleMania. And then we kind of went through like a, from a fan's perspective, we kind of went through like a 6 month lull. Like the summer was, even though SummerSlam 91 was an awesome show, felt like storylines were kind of in a lull. And then I was stoked when Sid came. And then the even bigger signing, of course, come September when Ric Flair arrived. And then the end of the year, Jake turning heel. It seemed like those last 6 months just got red hot. The product got crazy. And then you came along, and then everything just went bonkers.
Well, me coming along is what really set it on fire. But anyway, go ahead.
Well, that's the point. I mean, you were the foundation, and then everybody else is just icing on the cake. We all know that.
That's it. Okay, I'll buy that. Go ahead.
All right. Now, obviously, you eventually would obviously hook up with your boy, with your man. Sid Justice would be your charge as 92 would dawn. This is a part of wrestling history that's always very urban legend-ish, and we're glad you're here tonight to help us maybe clear it up.
I tell you, I'll answer the question before you ask it, and you tell me if I'm right. No, the finish in WrestleMania 8 was not a screw-up. No, Sid didn't refuse to kick out. No, none of that is true. Everything went exactly in the way that the company was happy with, put it like that. That's a bunch of BS. It's not true.
Well, you know, that's a question that one of our PTB Nation members was going to ask. We do our feedback later. So you did read his mind. So that wasn't my question, but you were close.
I'm going to say something else, too, what's funny. A few minutes ago, we were just kidding around, and I said, Flair came in and said, and this one and that one, but the whole the hot period in the 90s with WWE was causing me, and we laughed. You watch and see, you mark my words, some of these stupid dirt sites on the Internet are going to say, Bruno Lau or Harvey Wimpleman takes credit for the success of WWE. You watch and see.
That's good, though. That means a lot of people are listening to us. So that
yes,
might
that's
actually
right.
work
that's
out.
Right.
Yeah, no, that's right. You watch and see. He's goofed.
That was a question, though, that one of our PTB Nation members was going to ask you later. So I'm glad you actually saved us from you cut us. You got us at the right time. But actually, even before that, obviously when Ric Flair came in the fall, the big match everybody wanted to see. I mean, I've been a fan since 1983. So obviously the big match I wanted to see was Hulk Hogan and Ric Flair. That was
right.
Supposed to be what everyone thought was going to happen at WrestleMania 8 in Hoosier Dome. Obviously, it was Sid and Hogan and then Flair and Savage, which I think in the end ended up being a better end of the card anyway.
Right.
What happened there? Like, was that, if you could set the record straight, we'd love to hear it. Was that match ever truly supposed to be in place? Or was it always supposed to be Sid and Hogan and Savage and Flair? Was that always supposed to be the main event at WrestleMania? Or was Flair?
I mean, as far as I know, but let me just, I'm going to be really truthful with you now and take myself off the make-believe pedestal I put myself on a while ago. Honestly, especially then, being fairly new to WWE, I was not in, the creative sessions or the meetings or whatever. Just whatever, you know, I just took what I was given and did what I was told. So I don't know. I mean, I really, as far as I know, it was Sid and Hogan all along. But I mean, I don't know. Even to this day, though, I don't try to get involved in the process. It's where if something leaks out, they can't point their finger at little Bruno's. I didn't know, so I couldn't have put it out. You know, back then it wasn't the Internet; it was the dirt sheets. Meltzer, who's the at the time, you know, with the Wrestling Observer and everything, I didn't want to be known as the guy that gave him the scoops or whatever. So I didn't know. As far as I know, everything went according to plan, but as far as who wrestled who or whatever on that WrestleMania 8, but I could be wrong, you know, but as far as I know, that's the way it was.
And now coming off a big main event slot at Mania against Hulk Hogan, Sid was looked to be slated for a feud with the Ultimate Warrior, And then what happened, Bruno? Why did Sid all of a sudden up and vanish? What, you know, the rumors are many. They said he was upset about the payoff for Mania. There's rumors that he had failed the drug test during the steroid crackdown. You know, that was, of course, a rumor why Hulk Hogan had left as well. And there's even rumors to the point that you were taking tests for Sid to try and sneak him by. So can you clear all this up for us?
That ain't true. Okay. I can guarantee that ain't true.
Yeah.
Because there were people standing there watching each of us urinate. I had to urinate too. You know, all of us had to urinate in a little cup type thing, and it was the testing person standing there watching you urinate. It would have been impossible for me to urinate for Sid because they're watching your privates and they're watching, you know, you urinate into the test cup or whatever, what have you. So no, that I hated it when that got out, because it wasn't even close to being true. And it's just, why would right. somebody make up some shit like this when it just ain't true? Now, not urine as clean as a baby, because I don't use any drugs, never have. I drink a lot of beer, but last I heard, it wasn't illegal as long as you ain't driving. So that was never an issue. But no, that was not true. Now, at that time, when Sid left the WWE and I stayed, me and him went several years without even speaking, because he wanted me to leave with him, and I didn't go. Now, we've had some personal, you know, issues over that. It's personal discussions, and we've made peace with the decision he made, the decision I made at the time. So, basically, I've never really got a full disclosure. Some odds and ends, some personal things with Sid, too, that, you know, out of respect to our friendship and just out of respect to his privacy, I won't get into now. But, whether it had nothing to do with drugs or the use of or non-use of drugs, but it was just some business pressures and some personal pressures as well. And we've made peace, and Sid's made peace, and everything's good now. So it's just something that happened a long, long time ago.
Now, this is kind of a more humorous question, because it's a rumor that's been talked about involving him, about Sid all the time. Was he a big softball junkie?
Yeah, he always played softball in West Memphis and in Memphis. And in fact, he's even played against Lawler's team on different occasions. Who won? I don't know. I ain't going to say. I don't know.
Well, I was just saying, a lot of people say that he, you know, that up until, you know, the late 90s, the mid to late 90s, he wasn't given titles or title shots or promises because he would always take, you know, 4 months off in the summer or, you know, stuff like that because he wanted to go play softball. I just wanted to see if that was actually true or not.
Well, I know he played softball. I don't know about him taking off for that reason. I can't even speculate. He never told me that. I don't know. It always seemed like the timing looked like it was convenient to that story. It may be true. I don't know. He never told me, but I can verify that he was, at least, I don't know if he still is, an avid softball player here in the Mid-South.
Now, so Sid leaves, and as we head to the summer, you become manager for another big powerhouse guy, and that is the Ugandan giant Kamala. And you then begin a feud with The Undertaker. That would last the last 6 months of 1992, to a couple of matches, the big match at SummerSlam in London, and then actually the first casket match at the Survivor Series in Richfield.
Richfield, Ohio, suburb of Cleveland, before the Gund Arena was built. So
that's right.
So James is, Kamala, unfortunately, has had some health issues with diabetes and blood pressure and so forth. He's lost both of his legs. I understand he's in a wheelchair. He only lives about 30 miles from me, but we don't really stay in touch or anything, but I wish him the best. And, you know, I'm sorry for the circumstances that have me following him, but, you know, I hope he's able to keep his chin up and hope he's doing as well as possible.
What was he like when you first, I mean, he obviously was in the business for a long time. He had been in WWF, or WWE, a couple of times in the 80s, had a great feud with Andre the Giant in the early 80s, and then came back kind of the mid to late 80s, actually had a title feud with Hogan on the house shows. So he'd been in the business a while. What was it like working with him when you became his manager?
Man, I tell you, I don't know. I don't know. It's hard to... we're both from the same area, so we both, you know, have a lot of the same sensibilities and understandings about the business, but I don't know. I'm almost going to take a pass on that one, because I don't want to say anything disparaging, but I also don't want to lie. So I might just say I hope he's doing as well as possible, and I wish him the best.
Okay.
All right, well, passing now, by Kamala the person, or, you know, James Harris the person, Kamala the character, during this time, they kind of have a thing going where he was afraid of the Undertaker. He'd hide from him and run away from the casket. Did you think that was a smart way to book what was supposed to be kind of a monster heel?
Yeah, you know what? Yeah, I think so. I'll tell you why. Because it's the first time he had ever done that in the WWE. Now, he ran from Butch Reed in Bill Watts' territory at one time. Mm-hmm. That was a big, huge deal, and I got Butch Reed over huge. So, yeah, it's the same type of thing. Yeah, when you know, that really, really sells tickets. Because when you think about it, the first time ever the Ugandan Giant is scared to death of somebody and running and hiding. So the people are going to say, oh, my God, when the Undertaker finally gets him, he's going to kill him. He's going to put him in the casket.
Yep.
You know, literally, not literally, kill him. He'll put him in the casket, you know. So,
right. Yeah,
I thought at the time, now if he was running for everybody, because, you know, obviously he wasn't a chicken shit heel.
Right.
Which draws, a chicken shit heel has drawn money in every territory he's ever been. But that's like when Lawler was a heel, that's what he was. When Dutch Mantel was a heel, you know what I mean? The chicken shit heel.
Mm-hmm.
So Kamala was not that. He was the killer heel, the Bruiser Brody heel or whatever. So for him to be scared and run away, yeah, that's, I think, was booked exactly right. It got Undertaker over strong, and it made people say, oh, my God, we're finally going to see this Kamala get destroyed and put in the casket. He's scared to death of this guy. He's not going to be able to do nothing. So, yeah, I thought it was done very well, yes.
Interesting take. Very interesting. So at the time, too, of course, he had two managers, yourself and the masked Kim Chi. Who was generally portraying Kim Chi during that time? Was it usually Steve Lombardi?
Yeah, Steve Lombardi is one of my closest friends in the business and in the world. Yeah, we are very good friends and still travel together to this day, yes.
Yeah, it was a cool little trio. I always dug the three of you together. You know, Kim Chi was very good at the mannerisms without speaking. You know, he was very good at portraying
right.
that and getting that
right.
over, so...
You know who the original Kim Chi was? Or they didn't call him Kim Chi, I think they called him Friday when Kamala first debuted in Memphis.
You know, I knew it, and now I can't remember.
Buddy Wayne.
Okay.
Oh, okay.
That was the original.
Yes.
And then when Kamala went to work for Bill Watts, it was Frank Dalton.
Okay.
Oh, okay. I know Buddy Wayne. I know the name Buddy Wayne. I remember that in the magazines.
Yeah.
You had a pretty... I mean, this started a fairly long feud pretty much between you and The Undertaker, obviously crossing over different guys. We'll get to another guy in a minute, but what was Undertaker like to work with at this point? Mid-92, his character was, about a year and a half old, heading into the end of 92. It was almost 2 years. Was he still fairly green? Did he embrace the character? What was he like?
Oh, no, he wasn't green whatsoever. I mean, he was a natural. And he had, don't forget, he was one of the last territory guys. He'd worked Dallas, and he worked Memphis. And he had been in the ring with a lot of... That's how these guys became not green, because they worked in all the territories.
Right.
I mean, in Dallas, look at all the guys he had to work with there. Then he came to Memphis, worked with Lawler, worked with Dundee, worked with Ken Wayne, worked with, you know, whoever was, you know, in the territory at the time. So, Undertaker wasn't green when he came to New York. So, no, he was never green. He was a natural anyway. And, he was one of the best, still is one of the best... without a doubt, bar none, possibly, I'd say one of the top 10 in the history of the business. I think I'd go out on a limb and say that without a doubt.
Well, it takes a lot to last this long on top. I mean, to be as popular as he is. I mean, really,
yeah.
Whether he's a heel or a face, and whatever role he was in, he's always just been one of the top draws. And you know, even fans who don't watch anymore or only watch a little bit as children, you know, when you mention Undertaker, they know exactly who
right.
he is.
Yeah, I was more pertaining, I mean, yes, I mean, I remember he was me, Mark Alice, and he had a bunch of, I was more pertaining, like, to the character, like, the Undertaker character, which was so different, and I remember my brother was actually at the 1990 Survivor Series in Hartford, and I remember he said the fans, it was like this hush, and it wasn't a hush like, who the hell's this guy, it was more like hush like, wow, like, immediately, once he walked through the curtain, you believe this character, like,
he embraced it from the day he became the Undertaker, and believe me, it's developed and you know, metamorphosized and so forth over the years into different aspects, but, I mean, the day he had it. I mean, there was no, you don't quite have it, but he'll get it. No, he had it from from day one. And to all the internet people out there, I didn't say he might get it, he don't have it yet. I said there was none of that. Don't misquote me, damn it.
No, we will not allow that. Not at all.
Definitely not.
So, all right. So the feud with Kamala ended by the end of '92, but you were still feuding with The Undertaker. And
yeah,
now
John Gonzalez, my dear departed friend, who just couldn't get it. He just couldn't get it.
Well, he's, you know, as a character, he's probably one of our favorites here on the Place to Be podcast.
Yeah, he's kind of become a cult character here on the podcast.
Yes.
Out of
how
reverence.
Did that relationship start? Like, how did that relationship, like, did Vince come to you and say, I got a new big guy for you? How did that connection come about?
Pretty much, yeah, pretty much. And I said, that's fine. And I said, well, you're going to have to rent Cadillacs because he's too big to ride in a regular car. That's okay with me, as long as I don't have to pay for him, you know. And we worked out the deal. Where I, you rode with me. I drove him around. I was like his babysitter, and I took care of him. And he was a really nice guy. We became very good friends. And but he just didn't get it. He just couldn't grasp the business. He didn't have the. He wasn't a dumb guy by any means, but he just, I don't know, he just couldn't get the hang of it. I'm not dumb either, but I don't think you could teach me how to fix a computer, no matter what you did or how long you worked with me. I just couldn't get it, you know, and that's how he was with our business. And then we moved on to Mr. Hughes, and he couldn't grasp. Let me say this in a way without causing any strife. He couldn't grasp following the rules, basically. Let me put it like that.
Just going back to the debut at the Royal Rumble with Giant Gonzalez, was it your idea or, behind the scenes to change your look and style and kind of mannerisms? You still kept, obviously, the gruff voice and the Southern attitude, but
I gruff voice.
You're not normally using a British accent. No, so you went from kind of having that doctor gimmick with the little beret hat and the jacket and everything, and then you kind of got a little bit cleaned up and you had a suit and tie on instead. Was that your idea to kind of change the character up once Kamala left?
No, I never had an original idea in my life when I went to work there. I mean, I mean that with all honesty. I did what I was told and took what I was given, and the worst they ever gave me is the best I ever had. So I let them tell me what to do, and I did it. And there's only two times in the business you ever say no, and that's when you feel like you can't do something, or you feel like you'll either be hurt doing something or hurt the guy you're working with. Other than that, you do what you're told. And I don't care if they told me to wear a dress, I would have. You know, I don't care.
Well, you did eventually, right?
Yeah, it was anyway, yeah. But I don't care, you know. Yeah. But, yeah, they asked me to, you know, change up my look, just to change things up since I was going to be with a brand-new guy that was going to be in a main event deal, and I was happy to do it, and I did it. So, it wasn't my idea. I don't have no ideas. I don't want none.
I think it was a shrewd move by them because I think, like you said, if you were going to be bumped up to a main event level, I think it definitely made you look like a main event manager. I mean, not that you always weren't, but I think it helped.
It was like getting a brand new guy in the territory in the company with without having to bring somebody new in. So I had no problem with that.
Now, as that feud progressed, another guy jumped in the picture, and you mentioned him earlier, and we have to laugh about it because his character is synonymous with failures and shortcomings, and that's Mr. Hughes. I remember him in ECW, obviously, later on. I remember him in WCW and NWA. As nice as you can put it, I suppose, what was he like to work with? How did he get involved in the storylines involving Giant Gonzalez and Undertaker?
Well, because he was an excellent candidate to be a main eventer. At that time, he was, you know, 350 pounds or whatever, and his work was, you know, A+, 4 stars, and just looked like a killer, and just had that mean look, and just, when they told me I was going to be managing him, I was like thrilled, you know, because I knew him when he first broke in with Sonny Myers in Kansas City in '86. I remember him when he was first starting out. I said, oh man, he's really came a long way. He couldn't handle success and monetary compensation. Instead of me saying anything disparaging, I'll just put it like that. It was hard, man, because, I mean, we were going to be the main event with Undertaker, and then we weren't. And
And I remember that red hot beatdown from Superstars, where Gonzalez and Hughes and yourself, you smashed Paul Bearer with the urn and and knocked Undertaker out, and you knocked them both out of action. So, I mean, you're right. He was definitely primed, and the three of you were primed to become a main event, level heel stable.
And not long after that, I was managing Adam Bomb, and not long after that, I was managing Quang. Not long after that, I was managing Bertha Frey. And not long after that, I was getting hamburgers.
We're going to get to Bertha Frey in a minute, but actually, Adam Bomb was one of my favorite. Bruno, you've touched so many lives, even with the guys that everyone thought were nobodies. I mean, I was a huge Adam Bomb fan for Three Mile Island when he made his debut. One feud, though, that we feel started from the very beginning was the on-air feud you had with the great and Hall of Famer Howard Finkel.
That was a lot of fun. That was a whole lot of fun. Howard was one of my dearest friends in the business, and we had a blast. It was really fun. If Howard was a better worker, we could have made money on that. He's not supposed to be. I'm not putting him down by any means, because he's never been in the ring.
Right, you
know,
never had to.
Where I had for years, in different situations. But if we could have had a better match out of it, we could have made money. But it was, I don't remember now, but it's on all over the YouTube. I don't know if it was the 10-year anniversary of Raw or if it was the 100th episode.
I think it was the 100th episode, yep.
Was it the 100th? Yeah, I wrestled Howard. And I had Well Done in my corner, and the Bushwhackers were in Howard's corner. And I was standing on the middle rope, flexing or showing my muscles or lack of or whatever. And Howard reached in, and you can see this if you look at it, stuck his head between my legs and wanted to do that fall back tap like the Road Warriors or somebody would do. And I said, holy shit, he's going to kill me. And if you look, you can see the Bushwhacker looking up at me saying, don't let him do it, he'll hurt you, mate. And if you see, I hooked the ropes, I did everything, I was like Velcro. I wasn't going to let him do this. I don't know what got in his mind that he thought he was going to do a fall back Road Warrior freaking bump with me. He would have killed me. I'd have been right now. I'd be, moving through my house like blowing in a tube, like Stephen Hawking trying to, move my wheelchair.
Now, obviously, you had your battles with the Fink, and it all ended with this memorable tuxedo match. January. 5th.
Thank you for being so generous, but go ahead.
On the January 5th, 1995 Raw. Now, obviously, this was Fink's idea, since you have already mentioned you didn't have any. But was it, or unless you just don't want to admit it, because this was a great idea. What did you? Was it Fink's idea for the tuxedo match? Was it Vince's? Where did this whole concept come from?
I don't know if it was Vince, but it was the company. It wasn't Howard's idea. He didn't have any ideas either. I don't know whose it was, but I don't know who gets the credit or the blame for that one. I don't know.
Okay.
So but it was fun. It was fun,
Yeah.
I enjoyed it, I enjoyed it at that time. Some of my people that I'm closest with in the world were in the company at the time, Luna, and I were extremely close. And that is one of the few deaths in the business that really, really got to me, Luna. Because, we were just, it's hard to explain how much I loved Luna and still do to this day.
Well, and a very memorable character.
But more than that, there was a time Luna and I almost got married once. That's how close we were.
Okay.
That was just really hard for me to see her go. And I talked to her the day before she died.
Oh.
And we were talking about how we're going to see each other at the Cauliflower Alley deal when they give you that manager thing or whatever. It was just, right. Man, I can't get over it. That she was right there at the time we were hanging out together and everything. We were really close, And that was one of the hardest parts in my life to watch when I found out she died.
And I don't think she gets some of the credit she deserves as well throughout history. You watched, if you watch like some of those old Florida tapes and shows, and she was just so great back even then, before her.
She was one of the best. She was one of the best in every way, and a good person. People don't realize what a good Christian woman she was. But, God bless her. She's in a better place than us, that's for sure. Now, you want to hear that just brought a story to my mind. It's apropos of nothing we're talking about, but it's kind of funny.
Okay.
In our business. Years ago, if you remember, this ain't funny, but it leads up to something that is funny. Years ago, when Mike Von Erich committed suicide, you remember, the note he wrote to his father, Fritz, said, Dad, I've gone to a better place. Okay, which is very, you know, very sad and moving. I had people that were in the world-class organization at the time. One of my best friends, who's also dead now, unfortunately, Mike Davis, told me that Fritz Von Erich came in the dressing room and told those guys that his son left to go to work for WWE.
Oh, wow.
That's what he thought the note meant.
Oh, God.
And now here's another thing. Another good friend of mine who is not dead, he's still with us, so he can get razz for this. This is a true story. When Tony Falk heard that Mike Von Erich committed suicide, he called the world-class office and said he heard they had an opening for a baby face.
Oh, jeez.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. That's just Tony for you. You know, he didn't, he wasn't trying to be crass. He just wanted a place to go. So, it's a funny business. It's just, there's been, if you want to hear some more funny stories, I'll tell you a few.
Of course.
Absolutely.
Okay. You remember the late Crush?
Yes.
Yes. Yep.
Yeah. Another good friend of mine. He was an impressionist. He could do anybody's voice and do it better than the person themselves. So, when Tony Falk was wanting to go to work for Portland, Oregon, Tony's run was coming to an end in Memphis. He wasn't, you know, they weren't using him too good. And, you know, Tony needed a place to go. He had been in Puerto Rico before. He'd been in San Antonio before, but they weren't really making no money there. So he called Portland, Oregon to Don Owens. Well, I never worked there, so I don't know Don Owens, but I've, you know, heard a lot about him. He called up there wanting to come in. Mr. Owens, I'd really like to come in. I think I'd be a good talent, you know, for your organization. And the Don Owens fellow said, well, we have a lot of lumber mills up here, but they're on, 50% right now. And, you know, when they start going back up to 100%, we'll be drawing more houses. We'll bring you in maybe in a few months or whatever. So I can relate to that. It's the same down here with the cotton and everything where I live. So, you know, same difference. So anyway, you know, Brian Adams' Crush had, you know, been part of that organization for years and years and years. So he knew Don Owens. So when we were on the dressing room in Houston, Mississippi one night, and Tony Falk said, yeah, I called Don Owens, and he said that maybe in a few months when the lumber mills are back up to full capacity, he might bring me in. So I'm going to try to see if I can just stay here and work open a match for a few months and I can just make a living. And so Crush called up there doing that voice. Like, I did a pretty good job of it, but I mean, Crush sounded just like Tony Falk. And he called up there and said, Mr. Owens, this is Tony Falk. Yeah, I'll call you back and see when I can come in. I told you, Tony, the lumber mills are down right now and the houses are down, and you know, a lot of people are on unemployment right now or on seasonal compensation, you know, whatever it was. He says, in a few months we'll probably have a spot for you. I've heard good things about you. Len Denton said you were a good worker. And this is, now, bear in mind, this is Brian Adams. This ain't Tony Falk. But he said, well, let me tell you, Don Owens, you can just go fuck yourself. If you don't want to grab no money, then don't bring me up there, because I'll set your place on fire and the mills are closed down or not. They'll be sold out, every one of your arenas, if I'm up there. If you don't want to hire me, just kiss my ass.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, so... Then Brian Adams called up there the next day to smarten up the Don Owens guy and tell him that was him. He said the Don Owens guy wouldn't believe him. You must have made good friends with that Tony Falk guy down there in Memphis. I ain't buying it. Now, you're covering up for him. Now, he cussed me out. I don't want nothing to do with him. Now, he'll never come here the way he talked to me. But Don, it was me making fun of him. We don't believe it. You're just covering up for him.
Oh,
and he cussed Tony Falk every getting a job in Pacific Northwest.
Oh, man.
That's awesome.
But it was probably a blessing. Tony would have packed up everything he had, went left Nashville, went all the way up there, and they would have shut down. He'd have been stuck in Portland, Oregon. So it was probably a blessing. But, oh, my God, Crush wasn't a mean-hearted guy. He wasn't trying to hurt him.
Right, right. Playing around.
That's funny.
Yeah. There's been a lot of funny stories like that in our business. Okay, I've got 15 more minutes. I got to pick up my wife at 9:20, and it's 9:05. So, what else you want to know? Let's talk. Let's talk some more fun stuff.
All right. Let's. Well, not as fun, but we do wanted to ask it because our listeners did request or put the question out there. The night, of course, of July 4th, 1994, the car accident that took the life of Joey Morella and put you, through some serious injuries as well. Can you, tell us what you want to tell us? You don't have to go into more detail.
No, that's fine. Well, what it is it was just a series of events that must have been predetermined by the Lord Jesus Christ, because I feel that I don't know why else it happened, and I don't know why he caused Joey to die, but he must have wanted him for some reason, because everything was just out of whack that week. You know, me and Lombardi, Steve Lombardi, always traveled together. That week, Steve Lombardi was off. Mm-hmm. He had some obligations at home. I don't remember what it was, but he was off that week. So the only person I was managing at the time was in my big, huge, profiteering, money-making run with Quang in our opening matches with Bob Sparkplug Holly. Yeah. So that night, Quang wasn't even on the card. He was left off. He was in Ocean City, Maryland. So it was July, 4th. It was actually the 3rd of the day of the show. It was the 4th. You know, it was the next day. They told me I could go on home. So I was going to drive back to Newark, where my flight was out of, and then fly home. Joey was like, "No, dude. Oh, come on, dude. I don't have no ride back to Newark, dude. Please, just stay and drive me back to Newark. Please, I'll do all the driving. Please, just... Oh, come on, dude. I won't have no way back to Newark, dude." Oh, shit. I went around the whole company, and nobody wanted to take him. Oh, shit. All right. I'm staying around all day and night. He's in the main event, which was Bob Backlund against Bret Hart, I believe it was, if I ain't mistaken. So it's time to go. Let's go, Joey. Oh, look, he's showering. Jesus Christ, shower when we get to Newark in the hotel. Then... "Oh, dude, I don't want to be smelly like this. Come on, dude, I'll be out shortly." So I went outside and smoked a cigarette or whatever. I used to smoke back then. I don't know more. But anyway, came back in. He's sitting there playing cards with Mike Chioda. I said, "Oh, for Christ's sake, I'm going to leave it. Goodbye." "No, no, dude, here I come, dude. Don't worry, dude, I'll drive. You can go to sleep if you want to. Well, I'll wake you up, dude, if I get sleepy." Well, he woke me up all right, flipping that sumbitch over like that. I heard this biggest, loudest bang in my life. Bam! I didn't know what it was. I thought we had a blowout. I was asleep. I jumped up and looked. I couldn't tell what was happening. And God took my glasses off of me. They flew off my head because I can't see without them. I wouldn't know Brad Pitt from Bash and Booger without my glasses. I mean, I'm blind. So, holy shit. The car finally came to stop. I remember saying, "Oh, Jesus, take me to heaven." I remember saying that because I thought I was dead once I realized what was happening. The car came to stop, and I said, "Joey, you're dead, ain't you?" And he wouldn't answer me, so got my answer. And we were in up in Jersey, Morristown, New Jersey, and he talked about the circle of life. He got pronounced dead in the same hospital he was born in.
Oh, jeez. Oh,
wow.
We travel all over the country, all over the world. Imagine that, huh?
Wow.
Yeah. So, I was a lot more bitter a few years ago, and I put a lot more emphasis on the negative in my book, which I better plug that right quick because I ain't plugged it yet.
Of course.
If anybody wants to go to crowbarpress.com and get a copy of my book, Wrestling with the Truth, you'll find it very interesting, and I thank you for... in advance for buying one. But anyway, I'm learning to let a lot of things go. But I tell you, he didn't have to die. You know, I don't know what the deal was, and I don't even want to speculate. But he almost killed me too, and I'm glad he did, and I'm glad the Lord Jesus Christ seemed fit to let little Bruno stay on this earth a few more years. And 18 years now, going on 20 after that. And I hope Joey's, hope he's in heaven. He wasn't perfect, but who among us is? Nobody. Not me, not Joey, not y'all, not Charles Manson. you know, we all sin and fall short of the glory of God. So the only one that's definitely going to go to hell is the person that denies the existence of God. You know, that's basically the only sin that's unforgivable. The rest of them, look, God sort that out. The child molesters, the murderers, I mean, they should be in hell too. But anybody that would do that probably don't believe in God anyway, so that's where they belong.
Now, there was a lot of speculation, and I, obviously you were there, so maybe you saw it firsthand. From what people we've talked to and what we've read, after that happened, Gorilla Monsoon kind of, I don't want to say checked out, but they said maybe his demeanor changed. He was a little more down.
That's very true.
Sullen. Did that happen?
Yeah, it's very true. It's very true. And I can see it, you know. And it was hard when, you know, we talked on the phone several times, you know, during the week right after it happened. But to me, the breakthrough was the first time I had to do an interview with Gorilla, you know, on TV. And, of course, I was managing Clang or whoever, and he was, you know, Gorilla Monsoon. And, you know, we just went through this traumatic thing where his son was killed and I was in the car, whatever. And the breakthrough was when he goes, right now I've got Harvey Whippen with me. I said, let me tell you something, you know, good, blah, blah, blah. And we went back and forth. It, like, broke the ice. We went right back into the gimmick, you know, and it broke the ice big time.
And the weird thing was, too, with him is because of the taping schedule at the time, you know, all the matches were taped so far in advance that his matches were airing with him refereeing for, like, a month afterwards, and then they finally announced it. It was weird, you know, it was weird to see him out there.
That's right.
It's interesting, though, and we do know
you... What else is interesting is this conversation and this program. I love this. I'm having a blast. I'd like to do it again next week.
Well, actually, that's what we were just about to say, because we do know you have to go pick your lovely wife up. So what we can do is just kind of stop here, because we do have a lot more we wanted to talk to you about. And it may not be next week, because our schedule next week's a little weird. But what we can do is be in touch and soon and finish this up and go right through the rest of your career. Would that be okay?
Please do. I would love to. This is phenomenal. I'm enjoying it, and I think it's great. And I think y'all are great. And good luck on the show. Please send me another email. Call me, whatever you want to do. Let's set it up. Like I said, most time, Thursdays are the best time, like, you know, night about this time. And I would, like you said, y'all's schedule is a little different next week, maybe the week after.
Okay, definitely. Yes, we will, you know, we'll be in touch via email or call. But actually, just hang on the line first for one moment. PTB Nation, we're going to take a break, and then Scott and I will be right back to wrap up this interview. Thanks.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
How many pro wrestling news websites do you visit to get your daily news? 3, 4, maybe 5? Do yourself a favor and make that number 1. WrestleChat.net, the only professional wrestling news site that brings you all wrestling news all day long, and is home of the critically acclaimed Still Real to Us podcast, starring former CZW ROH and ECW announcer Eric Gargiulo and the champ Jeff Peck. That's WrestleChat.net. WrestleChat, it's where it's at.
Yes, WrestleChat.net, indeed, your home for everything pro wrestling. All the news and notes you need from WWE, TNA, Ring of Honor. They have a great message board. Check out their podcast, The Champ, Jeff Beck, and his announcer. And of course, while you're perusing the site, you look to the right, you see the PTB Gnome, proudly worn by Jordan Duncan. Click on it, and you'll go to our full archive, courtesy of our good friends at Podbean. That is WrestleChat.net, indeed where it's at. Also, don't forget the history of WWE.com, our friend Grant Cawthon. Outstanding research site, ring results, DVD reviews, everything you need is there. Also, check out our show on Stitcher.com if you have iPhone, Android, any kind of phone or any kind of player, tablet. Go to it. You can listen to our shows anytime. And then, of course, also on iTunes. And, of course, check out our message board, Bigelow34.proboards.com. We're always talking wrestling, sports, anything you want. Check out JR's and my reviews. We talk Raw, SmackDown, all sorts of stuff. And don't forget to help out our friend Jay Womet. Still dealing with a lot of physical issues with his leg and a touch of skin cancer, but he's a fighter, and he's a great fan of the show. And if you want to help him, check the link on our board, Bigelow34.proboards.com, and you can help him out. He's a great guy.
Hey, Place to Be Nation, this is Gary Michael Capetta, and this is the Place to Be Podcast,
with Scott Riscola and Justin Rosero.
All right, Scott, that wraps up part one of our interview with Bruno Lauer. Of course, he had other commitments, so he had to run, but we're going to have him back, as you heard, within the next couple weeks, and we're going to finish up. We've got to talk about, of course, the rest of his on-TV career as far as managing Bertha Faye and then transitioning to the referee role. And, you know, he's still there today, so there's a lot we got to ask him about. So what were your thoughts on the first half, though?
Oh, he was tremendous. You know, I'm glad that we've been able to do interviews with a combination of different people. We've interviewed people that have been in the business recently, like Stevie Richards. But it's nice to get a perspective from somebody who was back in the 80s, you know, who understood that. I'm very happy that he said that the territories are not indies. I kind of was hoping he'd steer that way because a lot of people think, oh, it was Memphis. It was a nice Midwest, you know, Southern indie promotion. No, it wasn't. He's exactly right. Those guys made a living. They worked 6 days a week. They're not like, oh, I'm going to go to Ring of Honor for 2 weeks and then shoot order to Japan and then go to Mexico. No, you made a living down there. It may not have been a lot, but it was a living. And that was cool that he talked about that. He was very respectful of people. I have to admit, I guess it was something about Kamala that nobody's supposed to know. I don't know, but it's very, very unusual. But
he's in a tough spot. He's a guy that, you know, he probably could burn some bridges if he wanted to just because of the position he's in. But, you know, that's his personality and his beliefs is that, you know, he doesn't need to come out here and flame anyone. That's not what we look for anyway. We enjoy the story. So that was a lot of fun. Big week next week, Scott. We're going to come back Monday with Cold Day in Hell. Looking forward to that show. And then Wednesday with our NFL preview, we're going to break down all the division races. We're going to break down who we think is going to the Super Bowl and the different awards. And, of course, our buddy Kyle Fischetti. So I guess I'm going to have to listen to Cowboys crap for 2 hours with you two.
Oh, yeah.
So,
get ready. How about them God. Cowboys?
We look forward to that. And maybe the week after we can get Bruno back in as well. So we got a lot going on. Visit us on our Facebook page, Place to Be Podcast, or the Place to Be Podcast live chats page. If you search for that, or ask me for the link, we can get that to you and get you added to the group. It's a lot of fun in there. We have a lot of ongoing conversation, and honestly, that's where the majority of our members now post a lot of things. So if you're not in there, come join us. The main Facebook page is pretty much just for updates for the show at this point. Also, visit us on Twitter, Place Number 2B Podcast, and on Tout as well. It's the same, Place Number 2B Podcast. We tout updates throughout the week on there. You can visit our message board, bigelow34.proboards.com. We have an NFL prediction contest that's starting up week one. You can get in on that. That's also where you can lead all your feedback for all our shows, and that's where we put the threads up each week as well. Yes. Of course, placetobe.podbean.com as well to listen to our shows and on iTunes and Stitcher Radio. Did I get everything, Scott?
Yes. How do you feel now after talking to him about your beloved Big Bully Busick? Do you feel at ease now?
Yeah, you know, I was looking for a little bit more, but I guess there's just not much to him. If Harvey can't give us any more detail, then the guy's just an enigma, you know? He gave us all.
Yeah, I know. There's really no other searching. And I'm actually very happy that he spoke in depth about what happened with Joey Morella, because that's one of those kind of things you don't really, you know, it's not one of those, it's one of those hushed tones kind of topics, but he was very open, and I had a feeling that, I had a feeling the theory was right, that Gorilla kind of, I didn't want to say checked out. Probably wasn't the right term, but you know what I mean.
He just wasn't the same.
Yeah, he wasn't the same. He kind of lost his, almost lost his desire and love for the business. And I tell you, in the midst of all of the vaults we're doing right now, you know, he was on camera a lot in early to mid '97. Still looked good. I mean, the guy was a pro. He wasn't going to totally tank
out there
him,
and did his job. And you know, the other thing that kind of came up during that conversation that surprised me was his relationship with Luna Vachon. You know, very touching there as well. And kind of a heartfelt sentiments. But, you know, a lot of good stuff. I loved hearing about the territories and all that. That, you know, something we don't always get to touch on. So, you know, I'm sure a lot of our older fans or even younger fans that weren't never aware of what the territories were like will get a kick out of Bruno talking about his days down in Alabama and Continental and Memphis. And, you know, Continental's a territory you don't hear much about, but it was always, from what I understand, very red hot with Robert Fuller running it. And then I know Paul Heyman and Eddie Gilbert were involved towards the end as well, so a lot going on there. So we'll go ahead and wrap up, Scott. Like we said, next week we get two big episodes coming, and then we will have part two of this Bruno Lauer interview coming sometime in early September, where we'll talk about the rest of his WWF on-screen career and then transition to backstage where he still works today. So a lot going on. We want to thank Bruno for joining us, and Scott, as always, thank you. You did a lot of great pre-production work on this interview. So,
oh, no problem. It was a pleasure.
Finally starting to carry your end of the bargain a little bit.
Well, you know, I did write it with a quill, and I was hoping he was going to talk about the Tootsmont years, but he didn't go that far back, so sorry.
All right, PTV Nation, we're going to wrap things up. You have a great weekend. We'll talk to you next week. Thanks.
Peace.
If I said it, I meant it. Bite my tongue for no one. Call me evil or unbelievable. Out the sunroof, Alexis coupes, leave no witnesses. What you think this is? Ain't no amateurs here. I damage and tear. MCs fear me. They too near not to hear me. Clearly, I'm the triple beam dream. 1,000 grams of uncut to the gut. It seems fucked up the way I touched up the grill. Trying to play gorilla when you ain't no killer. The gas by your liver, your upper lip quiver. You're ready to die. Tell God I said hi. Some ice for the nicest MC. Niggas know the steelo, unbelievable.